Putin's Russia, today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. Elections are coming up in Russia, and many voters are consumed with one idea.
It's this idea that, you know, Russia has made its way back from irrelevance, from the abyss, and it's back thanks to one guy, Vladimir Putin.
Also, Steve Bannon addresses a far-right rally in France.
He's been ousted of the White House. He's out of Breitbart. He doesn't really have much to go on right now. And so when he showed up at this rally, he knew that he had a crowd that was looking at him favorably.
Plus, alpha male crocodiles get displaced by floods in Australia.
The other males think, hello, here I am, I could become the dominant male. And so they become very full of bravado, if you like, and they become dangerous to people.
Those stories today on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Good to have you along. We begin today with, well, you remember him.
Our populist nationalist movement in the United States is maybe 10 or 15 years old. We are here to learn from you.
That's former White House advisor Steve Bannon speaking this weekend to supporters of France's nationalist Front National Party. It was a surprise visit. The party loyalists who gathered in Lille seemed glad to welcome Bannon. On Sunday, the day after Bannon spoke, Marine Le Pen, the head of the Front National, proposed rebranding the party's name, making it Rassemblement National, the National Gathering. To talk about American populism and nationalism meeting its European counterpart, specifically its French counterpart, we've got reporter Adeline Seal with us. So Bannon's no longer part of the Trump administration, essentially doesn't have the power he once did. So he has a lot to gain from this tour of Europe. But why do you think he was invited to France? What does a National Front want to learn from him?
Well, a lot of political analysts were scratching their heads about this, because if you want to rebrand and revamp your party, which is what Marine Le Pen is trying to do, it's interesting that you would want to have a political figure which was ousted of the White House and has lost a lot of its power. The New York Times actually called him and Marine Le Pen two slumping political figures. This political analyst who follows extremism was actually saying that perhaps for Bannon, it was a sort of PR coup that, you know, he may be hoping to become a consultant in Europe, rising nationalism. I mean, you see it all over the place, certainly, even though his role in the United States has been fading.
Yeah, a lot to unpack here. So part of this name change, that rebranding that Marine Le Pen is proposing, Rassemblement National, or the National Gathering, I know it's getting some pushback on a copyright basis from a group that says they already have the same name. But is this a National Gathering rebranding? Is it part of Marine Le Pen's new push for inclusivity? Is it just a cosmetic change?
We'll have to see, but that's the question that's been asked right now exactly, because certainly rally, National Gathering sounds a lot more inclusive than National Front. I mean, that is sort of old-fashioned and sounds aggressive. Don't forget that it was the name picked by the founder, Jean-Marie Le Pen, who is a notorious anti-Semite. So in a way, Marine Le Pen knew she had to completely cut ties with her father, the founder of the party, give it a new name, and try to pass for more inclusive. But, you know, during that weekend, one of the leaders of the party was also caught in camera yelling racist slurs at someone. You know, you could say, in a way, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. I mean, they're going to have to prove, if they want to be more inclusive, that overt racism and racism, period, is no longer tolerated in this party. And they certainly have ways to go before people can trust that is the case.
So as he spoke to this conference in Lille, Steve Bannon said this.
Those people in Brussels and in Washington, D.C., that have foisted economic hate crimes on the black and Hispanic working class. It took someone like Donald Trump, who they run down as a racist every day, to solve the problem of the black and Hispanic working class.
So Steve Bannon then goes on to tell the room, let them call you racist. Wear it as a badge of honor. And it's confusing because in that room, you've got Marine Le Pen, who's made no effort to hide her Islamophobia. And at the same time, she's trying to rebrand this nationalist populist party. What's going on?
I think Marine Le Pen is caught between a rock and a hard place. I mean, she performed very poorly after she lost the presidential election. And so she is struggling to give the party a new image and move forward. But there is the specter, if you will, of her father, the founder of the party, still weighing her down. On the other hand, there is her niece, Marine Maréchal Le Pen, who is a lot more politically savvy. She's 28, so she has her whole life ahead of her. As you know, she gave a speech that was appreciated at CPAC. And
the Conservative Political Action Conference.
Yeah, and Marion Maréchal Le Pen may very well be the future of nationalism in France. But Marine Le Pen seems like she's very much in the past, and I'm not sure she's going to be able to make any progress, even with a new name.
Well, I hear Marianne Maréchal Le Pen is also brushing up on her English, so maybe she's seeing a kind of an international coalition of nationalist populism. Who knows?
I mean, it's funny to say that, but it seems that Marion Maréchal Le Pen would be the more worldly candidate for a National Front party in France, even though that's what they hate. They seem to have no problem brainstorming across the continent with the US and elsewhere and sort of exchanging ideas and tips on how to grow their respective nationalist parties. In a way, that is also maybe a new trend in nationalism.
Reporter Adeline Cyr speaking with us from Auxerre in France. So clearly there are close ties between some people on the far right of American politics and their counterparts in Europe. But there are also differences. An essay by Jeet Heer in The New Republic last month explored both sides of that equation.
There is a kind of informal network between the European far right and the American alt-right, and sort of, you know, these connections between Steve Bannon and the Le Pen family are one wing of it, and we also see ties with figures like Nigel Farage of England. And I think what really unites these figures is issues of sort of immigration and Islamophobia and, frankly, racism. They're kind of united by a fear that sort of, you know, white Americans and white Europeans are under siege and have to defend themselves.
Now, you also wrote about conservatism in Catholic circles and the connection to Spain. Can you maybe just talk about that briefly?
Sure. Yeah, I think a lot of these conservatives in the National Review circle, including L. Brent Bozell Jr., who was the speechwriter for Barry Goldwater, they believed that to win the Cold War, you needed a powerful alternative. And they thought that liberal democracy was too weak. And for them, the real alternative was Franco's Spain. So Bozell and his wife, William F. Buckley's sister, ran a sort of summer camp for young conservatives, where every summer they would go to Franco's Spain, this sort of fascist country, and really live the good life. And that was upheld as, like, this is the type of society we want to live in.
Today, where would you kind of orient Catholic conservatives in this whole kind of universe?
I think it's interesting that the American Catholic conservatives are the ones that are among the most friendly towards this outreach to the European far right. And you certainly see figures like Ross Douthat of the New York Times, who are very, very friendly towards Le Pen. And I think one aspect of this is that they see these European movements as being very Catholic in orientation, which they are, culturally Catholic, and also different type of conservatism. It isn't the sort of individualistic Protestant conservatism that we're used to that celebrates the free market. It's a very conservatism that's rooted in natural law and believes, you know, like in things like pro-natalist policies, is friendlier towards the welfare state. I mean, I think that's a really significant thing, that in keeping with sort of Catholic social traditions, this form of right-wing politics sees nothing wrong with having, you know, a universal healthcare and labor unions.
So you've mentioned a lot of names, Barry Goldwater, William F. Buckley, more recently, Marine Le Pen and Ross Douthat. Where would you put Steve Bannon on the spectrum?
I think Bannon really comes out of that older tradition, although he's much younger than people like William F. Buckley, obviously. If you look at his writing, he's very interested in sort of Catholic thinking, Catholic social thought, and he really orients himself towards the European Catholic right. And so I think that it's no accident that he ended up in France at a National Front rally. Like, I think that in some ways that is his ideal politics.
So are there huge differences between the conservative Catholics and kind of like the individualistic driven Protestants? Doesn't that impact right-wing ideology?
Yeah, I think that there are like sort of theoretical differences. I mean, they don't really get played out in America because there really isn't enough of sort of a conservative mass base that, you know, wants the full Catholic agenda. But I mean, definitely if you look at like the writings of these Catholic reactionaries, they're often much friendlier towards the welfare state. Perhaps ideally the welfare state for white people, but I mean, still, like the National Front in France, like almost all other French political orientations, believes in universal health care. So I do think that there's a kind of skepticism towards the market and a belief that the free market isn't necessarily always right. And maybe you get that in some aspects of Trumpism as well, like his protectionism, you know, because he does embody on some level a type of conservatism that's happy to use state intervention to protect his people. It's a very tribalist view of life and society. And so you don't necessarily celebrate the individual or the free flow of capital or think that business decisions are always right. So I do think that there is a kind of like a tension.
What does that bode for the future, do you think?
Well, I think that there could be real divisions opening up at some point. Like, I do think that the degree to which Trump has aligned himself with the Paul Ryan wing could disenchant him with a lot of the sort of alt-right figures that, you know, that don't necessarily believe that big business should dominate. And in fact, often have very sort of conspiratorial and anti-Semitic views about what big business is and what their intentions are.
Jeet here of The New Republic. Thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
Here's a quick news note from North Queensland, Australia. People there are being warned to get ready for crocodiles and snakes in unexpected places in the coming days. Not the kind of warning you ever want to hear from your local government. And for the good residents of North Queensland, it comes on the heels of devastating floods last week. Hundreds of homes underwater, schools closed, and a state of disaster declared. As if all that weren't enough, the waters floated in snakes and crocs. The biggest concern, apparently, are the male crocodiles, says John Lever. He owns a crocodile farm in central Queensland and spoke with the BBC about the problem.
Well, we're talking about the saltwater crocodile, which is the largest crocodile species in the world. We have crocodiles here over 1 ton in weight and, you know, 5.3 meters long, but they can grow up to 7 meters long. They're fairly isolated animals, you know, they don't even like each other very much, you know. So you get a large male that becomes an alpha male in a river system. He's the dominant male. He takes over all the females. And then suddenly he's not in the river system anymore because of the floodwaters. Then other males think that, hello, here I am. I could become the dominant male. And so they become very full of bravado, if you like, and male macho sort of stuff, and they become dangerous to people. So the Queensland National Parks and Wildlife Service have got rangers out there who, when they get reports of crocodiles in strange locations, they go out and assess the issue, catch the crocodiles. They don't put them back in the wild. One bend in the river may make the difference between a male crocodile's territory and another male crocodile's territory. So translocation really doesn't work. So these crocodiles are placed on crocodile farms or in zoos around Australia. They've even taken the option of just removing the crocodiles by shooting them if they pose a great danger to people.
That was John Lever, owner of the Kurana Crocodile Farm in Queensland, Australia. Just ahead, all aboard Russia's nuclear icebreaker to a glorious Russian tomorrow. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with the world. Russians go to the polls next weekend to vote for president, and we already know who will win. President Vladimir Putin is pretty much guaranteed re-election. Many Russians believe Putin is the man who's lifted their country off its knees and promises to restore Russia to its former glory. Over the next few days here on The World, we'll be hearing stories about this Russian yearning for power and what it means for the future. Let me bring in our reporter, Charles Maines, who joins us on the line from Moscow. How do you want to introduce us to what we're going to hear this week, Charles?
Well, you know, Marco, I wanted to launch things off by actually just going back to a launch. This is one that I witnessed a little while back. This is back in the summer of 2016.
Главному строителю заказа доложу генеральному директору о готовности заказа к спуску на воду.
So we're at the Baltic Shipyard, a Soviet era factory in St. Petersburg, and we're looking out at the Finnish Gulf. And I was there to watch the maiden launch of the Arktika. That's the first of a new fleet of next generation nuclear icebreakers that the Russians are building. Now, I've never been on, say, an aircraft carrier, but this ship, the Arktika, you know, it's massive. It's the size of a football field. And the Russians, you know, they build this thing as not only the world's largest nuclear icebreaker, but also the world's most powerful.
Yeah, and I read somewhere that Russia is the only country that actually builds nuclear icebreakers, so I guess they don't get a Guinness record by default.
Well, that's true. But still, this is a big deal because all of Russia's old nuclear icebreakers, they've all been in service since before the end of the USSR, before the end of the Soviet Union. And, you know, so they're all near the end of their shelf life. And meanwhile, Russia sees the Arctic as really key to its economic security looking into the future. And these nuclear icebreakers, they play a key role in that. And for another reason, because Russia wants to establish itself as a shipping power across this fabled North Sea route.
That's that route across kind of the top of the world if you're looking at a traditional map.
Right, right. But, you know, in short, you know, the Arctica, this ship, it's a symbol of Russian state power. And so, no surprise, the Russian state turned out for the occasion that day. You know, we had military marching bands, soldiers in salute. The Orthodox Church was also there. They were there to bless the ship. Even if the mic didn't exactly work, it kept cutting out. You know, and what would this occasion be without politicians to take credit for the ship? So there were all sorts of speeches from lawmakers in the Duma and the Russian Senate, the Federation Council.
Yeah, what'd they have to say?
Well, surprise, a lot of the speeches were rather boring. But remember, this is all coming at a moment when Russia is under sanctions, under Western sanctions over its annexation of Crimea, which, of course, it still is. But these sanctions, you know, they include preventing Western oil and tech companies from doing business with Russia. And, you know, that was all intended as a punishment to do everything, really, to stop Russia's development in the Arctic, among other places. So it's really intended to strike at Russia's economic security. And, you know, here in all these speeches, you literally had people saying to the West, look, like, this massive ship, the Arctica, you know, this is our answer to your sanctions. You know, and if we can do this, we can do anything.
So how did the launch go?
Well, they did it. You know, it launched, and of course, everyone went crazy. And as this enormous ship floated into the harbor, you know, people were cheering, taking photos, selfies with them in the atomic icebreaker in the background. You know, and I approached this worker from the shipyard, a guy named Pavel Gorbachev.
Gorbachev as in the Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev, any relation?
No relation. In fact, okay. This Pavel says he hates his last name for that reason. He blames Gorbachev, you know, not himself, of course, but the Soviet leader. You know, he blames him for ushering in democracy and then ruining a factory. Pavel was bubbling over with excitement. You can kind of hear it in his voice here. And it's because he was so relieved nothing had gone wrong with the launch. And he's also telling me that he's excited because, as he said, you know, this meant Russia was back as an Arctic power. You know, the Arctic is ours, he kept telling me. The Arctic is ours. You know, and it was hard to argue with Pavel, you know. I mean, here it is. We're, like, literally looking at Russian power, a nuclear icebreaker, and it's expanding, well, okay, drifting into the harbor.
Drifting. I hear a little skepticism there, Charles.
Well, you know, yes and no. I mean, of course, these guys at the factory, you know, they've all seen this launch before, in a way. I mean, this factory used to produce these nuclear icebreakers for the Soviet Union. And then for 25 years, it kind of went dormant. They all tell these stories of how the factory nearly went bankrupt or nearly bankrupt and come back from the dead once again. And, you know, so I asked Pavel, this Pavel Gorbachev, I said, like, look, does this feel like old times, you know, what Russians call the good old days, half jokingly sometimes. And he said, yeah, exactly that, the good old days.
Да, да. Я всегда себя чувствовал человеком империи, блин. Сейчас тоже начинаю чувствовать.
So Pavel, this is Pavel saying, you know, he used to feel like he was part of an empire, and he's starting to feel like he's part of one again.
Wow, that really crystallizes things.
Yeah, you know, it really made an impression on me because I don't think I've ever quite heard it put so plainly. But the idea, I think, is central to understanding modern Russia. It's this idea that, you know, Russia has made its way back from irrelevance, from the abyss, and it's back thanks to one guy, Vladimir Putin.
KGB operative handed power by Boris Yeltsin, then becomes president, prime minister, president again, and probably president again this month.
Well, that's true. We have elections coming up. As you know, Putin's been in power for 18 years now. He's up for re-election for a fourth term next week, which he will win. Nobody doubts that. And as much as he's running a campaign, it's this. It's this idea that he's rebuilt Russia. It's Russia's risen from its knees, as they like to say here. But not only that, 18 years, of course, is a long time, and Putin's arguing that given another six-year term, Russia can do even better. You know, he can shepherd Russia forward into this kind of glorious future, a 21st century defined by Russian victories, as he put it recently.
So just a reminder, Charles, the reason we're talking is because we're looking into this possible renaissance of power in Russia all this week. What is the first story we're going to hear?
Well, we're going to look at Russia's war or sort of proxy war in East Ukraine to begin with and the way that's impacting some of the soldiers involved in it. We'll also be looking at the war in Syria. Russia's been certainly launched this military intervention in Syria, which they claim is a good war, and we'll be looking at how they're actually fighting that. We'll also be checking in with trolls in St. Petersburg. We'll be looking at corruption. We'll be looking at the elections coming up. So all sorts of things that all really kind of scratch at this idea of, you know, is Russia back? Is it all real? Or is it just some kind of ghost empire that creates this illusion of power? Or is it something in between? And, you know, I'm not sure we'll get to answers to all those things, but that's certainly the larger picture we're hoping to engage with. And I imagine these questions will go far beyond these elections and into the future, but I certainly hope people will tune in.
Charles Baines in Moscow, really looking forward to the whole series. Thanks for starting us off.
Thank you.
As you heard, tomorrow we'll be digging into Russia's role in the war in Ukraine. Charles has the story of a Russian soldier captured there and his mother's battle to pressure President Putin to get him back.
I want him home in Russia. How it's done and on what level doesn't matter. I want to see him, and I hope the Russian government will help.
Again, that's tomorrow here on the show. Also, check out Charles's essay on what he calls Russia's ghost empire, plus a collection of so-called demotivator memes from Russia. That's all at PRI.org. I'm Marco Werman. Many young Iraqis don't remember Saddam Hussein or the U.S. invasion that toppled him.
They really don't have any sense of having been liberated from, you know, some awful dictatorship. That is ancient history to them.
But they do remember the more recent battles against ISIS. What that says about their future ahead on the world. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. This month marks 15 years since the U.S. invaded Iraq. It is hard to believe, and as we're about to hear, it's also ancient history for many Iraqis.
The worst of our problems these days is traffic jams.
Businessman and economist Hassan Haddad believes Iraq is starting to turn a corner. Haddad has spent much of his life in Canada, but he returned to Iraq in 2013 to start a new life. A few days ago, he found himself at a Baghdad startup called The Station. It's a shared incubator space where techies and artists come together.
It's a place basically for young entrepreneurs to connect with each other and learn from each other. There was actually a piano concert Friday night that I was lucky enough to attend. When I was there, there were five or six different performers. And when you're there, I leaned to my friend and I was like, are we in Baghdad? It was the first time that I go to such an event in Baghdad. It was just beautiful.
That sounds really heartening. An incubator suggests people taking new innovative ideas and finding ways to make them real. Is this the first kind of incubator in Baghdad that you know of?
I think it's the first in all of Iraq, to be honest with you. It's a great initiative that was established by, you know, a bunch of 20-somethings. You know, they're basically getting loans to make this happen, and they put it together. It looks very modern.
What are the other signs that Baghdad is kind of open for business right now?
Security has improved dramatically, I would say, in the last 12 months. Other than the occasional lapse or fault in security here and there, for the past several months, there have been no major incidents or acts of terrorism. And so that's brought a lot of private sector movement here.
I mean, I think of Baghdad as a city full of blast walls and security checkpoints. Is that still the case?
It is not. One of the initiatives that the government has taken on is to beautify Baghdad by taking down those blast walls. Baghdad is several centuries old, and it's a naturally beautiful city. So There have been orders, you know, coming down from the prime minister saying, take down the blast walls. We need to open up the side streets. There's a lot of beautiful buildings and architecture that we need people to see. And there's been a lot of pressure applied on the government to improve services and decrease corruption.
What about the fears, though, of the Iraqi Sunni minority? I mean, their anxiety is real, and they don't think the upper echelons of Iraq's government and military, that they're interested in their safety.
Many of my friends who are Sunni don't have those fears whatsoever. If anything, they say the fact that the majority Shia, you know, federal police and popular mobilization forces and Iraqi army, they laid their lives on the line for mostly Sunni areas to be liberated. And they paid the ultimate sacrifice to liberate mostly Sunni areas. This means that they truly value the lives of all Iraqis. And so I don't think those fears exist. And if they do, it's a very small voice. And it's certainly not here in Baghdad, where sectarianism amongst the populace, not amongst the politicians, is more or less finished.
You sound so optimistic about the future and so confident. I'd just love to know, what keeps you awake at night? Where do you think there is an Achilles heel for Iraq's future?
To be honest with you, if I were to think about all the things that could go wrong, I wouldn't sleep. But the fact of the matter is, it's first time in 7,000 years of history, Iraq is a democracy. We either take it and run with it, or we waste the opportunity. ISIS has been defeated militarily. The economy is rebounding. There's people who are going into the private sector and doing great things. There is hope, and it is tangible. And that's why I'm still around, to be honest with you. If I didn't have hope, I wouldn't stick around.
Economist Hassan Haddad now works at the Iraqi government's Economic Reform Unit in Baghdad. Good to have you on the show. Thank you.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
Journalist Vivian Walt spent 2 years in Iraq after the 2003 U.S. invasion, but she hadn't been to Baghdad for a decade until she returned last month. She found the city had changed in some startling ways.
The streets were absolutely packed with young Iraqis because it was the first night of the spring break, and families were piling into restaurants.
Walt's optimism, though, was tempered.
Certainly a lot of people in the government are very sunny about the prospects. Look, this is a country that on paper anyway has great prospects. It has massive oil reserves, the fifth largest in the world, and it has every reason to be optimistic about its economic future. The real problem is that there has been so much dysfunction over so many years, and we're not talking about just in the last 15 years since the invasion of Iraq by the US, but, you know, for decades previous under Saddam, that there is really a very, very entrenched system of corruption, for example, and everybody will admit that. And in my interview with the Prime Minister, Haider al-Abadi, he says corruption is absolutely endemic, that it is pervasive, and that it is actually the most overwhelming problem that the country faces.
How many years had it been since you'd set foot in Baghdad?
Well, I would say I have not been in Baghdad for a good 10 years. So it was a city I knew pretty well, but coming back after a decade's absence was really kind of startling in some ways.
Yeah, what struck you instantly when you arrived about how the city had changed?
There are no Americans around. Mm. There are checkpoints everywhere. You still have a lot of armed people, a lot of uniformed people, and barbed wire and everything that there always was. But this is 100% Iraqi at this point. And that has completely changed the whole flavor and the nature of the city.
In what way?
It really does feel very much that in as much as there are big problems to sort out in this country, it's the Iraqis' problem, and that there is very much a sense of kind of ownership of people, you know, once again feeling sort of patriotic pride and really feeling like they want to rebuild the country. Of course, much of that has to do with the aftermath of the terrible war against ISIS and the feeling of relief and victory after having destroyed the ISIS caliphate. And that was a very binding experience for a lot of Iraqis, at least for the 3 years in which Iraqis were heavily engaged in fighting ISIS, they were far less engaged in fighting each other.
Vivian, tell us about some of the younger Iraqis you met, because it's kind of remarkable. Many of them don't remember life under Saddam Hussein.
According to UN statistics, about 40% of the country was actually born after the U.S. invasion.
40%?
Yes. And certainly, you know, a good number of them had been very small kids when the U.S. Invaded. So I met a lot of people who were in their kind of early 20s, just starting their careers. And they say they had a vague memory of bombs falling, and they never really understood what was going on. They just remembered that they had been sort of fleeing Baghdad for some granny's house up in the country. And then there are a whole lot of other Iraqis who really are post-Saddam kids. They were born into a war. They've been living really their entire lives under conflict from of one sort or another. And at this point, they really don't have any sense of having been liberated from, you know, some awful dictatorship. That is ancient history to them. They want jobs. They want a functional government. They're sick of corruption. You interview a lot of people in their 20s, and they'll all tell you stories about being shaken down for bribes here and there, and especially bribes in order to get jobs. So they feel themselves to be in this kind of cycle of corruption, and they don't see the government as having done very much to really crack down on it.
So with those fresh eyes and minds, in your opinion, Vivian, what does that spell for how Iraq could evolve differently at this point, like without corruption, for example?
You know, the good part of it, I think, is that you have a whole generation, and maybe we now need to talk about the ISIS generation, the generation of youth that have been coming of age during this fight against ISIS. And I think for a lot of them, they don't necessarily see themselves as being primarily Sunni Iraqi or Shiite Iraqi, that there is something larger than that to them, and that they do much more kind of identify with the nation and the central government. That said, they are certainly going to demand that the central government deliver what they want them to deliver. But the optimistic prism, I guess, is that you might have a gradual sort of fading out of these very regional, ethnic, territorial battles that have really plagued Iraq for decades at this point.
Vivian Walt, who recently was in Baghdad on assignment for Time magazine. Thank you very much, Vivian.
You're welcome.
President Trump is scheduled to travel to California tomorrow. He plans to check out border wall prototypes there, among other things. It could be an awkward visit, though. California has filed multiple lawsuits against the Trump administration. And last week, the Justice Department sued California over the state's efforts to protect immigrants from detention and deportation, which prompted Governor Jerry Brown to accuse the Trump administration of basically going to war with California. Saul Gonzalez is a reporter with station KCRW in Santa Monica. So war or not, Saul, California is overwhelmingly Democrat. Trump loves being with people who like him. Why do you think he's making this trip? Is it just photo ops?
Well, I think he wants to see these border wall prototypes. I mean, it was central to his campaign that this wall gets built. This is the only manifestation of that idea. So I think, number one, he wants to see these prototypes on the border. They're basically just eight hunks of cement or concrete that are standing upright. And then afterwards, he'll be addressing some members of the armed forces at a Marine Corps air station, and then heading up to my neck of the woods here in Los Angeles to earn a lot of money at a swanky soiree where they're charging, I believe, the lowest price tickets are going for $30,000, $35,000, up to $250,000.
Wow.
And, you know, he's coming to a state, it's no breaking news, he's coming to a state that doesn't love Donald Trump. This relationship has gone from bad to worse during his first 14 months in office. But I think he also knows that if he gets criticized in California, that's very appealing to his base.
So we know he likes to slam Nancy Pelosi, the California representative and House Minority Leader. And over the weekend, he accused another veteran California representative, Maxine Waters, of having a low IQ. As you said, there are some Republican politicians in California. What does his visit mean for them?
I think it means staying clear of Donald Trump, quite frankly. I think if you're a
the Republicans.
For the Republicans, there are not a lot of Republicans who particularly represent coastal areas of the state, and that's where Trump is going to be, who are standing in line to meet Donald Trump at official events. Sure, there will be some who will be around him, absolutely. But there are a lot of Republicans who I think making this calculation that it is not in my self-interest, particularly if I'm running for Congress here in coastal Southern California, in the L.A. area, San Diego, Orange County, to be seen with this man right now. It would be a whole other thing entirely if he was going to like a rural part of the state, maybe Bakersfield or Fresno, where you could be more sort of out and proud in your support of Donald Trump. But, you know, anything along, you know, the I-5 corridor between San Diego and Los Angeles is not a place where you openly embrace Donald Trump.
What's expected as far as protests?
Well, protests are being organized both for his San Diego visit and his Los Angeles visit. A lot of groups like Indivisible, they say they're going to put hundreds, maybe even thousands of people out there on the streets or at the border and at this fundraiser here in Los Angeles. I've been monitoring some of the social media around this, and they're quickly organizing these protests. Now, whether they get thousands out there or some hundreds of people, we'll have to wait and see until tomorrow.
You know, it's easy to imagine California winning the PR war here. Its economy is super strong. And in a letter Governor Brown just wrote to Donald Trump, he attributed that success to, quote, immigrants and innovators from across the globe, end quote, and also not to being isolationists. And then on the other side, you've got things like this disturbing video that went viral on Facebook that shows federal agents taking a mother away from her sobbing kids. And in the 90s, we should recall that California tilted strongly Democrat, and some say that was a reaction to so much heat that immigrants were dealing with at the time. Could we see the same kind of dynamic emerge from this Trump visit to California?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, California essentially has modeled itself as the anti-Trump enclave nationally and maybe even globally. And I think what Jerry Brown and other elected officials are saying, both in official pronouncements and in tweets, is we are the anti-Washington, D.C., at least under the Trump administration. We are the state that's looking to the future. We're not talking about reviving the steel industry, reviving the coal industry. We're all about solar. We're all about geothermal. We're all about wind energy. We're all about, you know, making bridges and not walls. And I think that cleavage between where the rest of the country is going, or at least big swaths of the country is going under Trump, and where California is going is just becoming more and more apparent, where we've set ourselves on a different path here in California. And it's very difficult for kind of a pro-Trump message here to get through all of that.
Saul Gonzalez, a reporter at KCRW in Santa Monica and host of the podcast There Goes the Neighborhood, Los Angeles. Always good to speak with you. Thanks a lot, Saul.
Hey, thanks, Marco.
Quick update on what appears to be an incident of deliberate poisoning in the UK last week. I'm talking about the case of Sergei Skripal. He's the former Russian spy who was found unconscious, along with his daughter, outside a shopping center in the southern English town of Salisbury. Today, British Prime Minister Theresa May had this to say on the investigation.
It is now clear that Mr. Skripal and his daughter were poisoned with a military-grade nerve agent of a type developed by Russia. This is part of a group of nerve agents known as Novichok. Based on the positive identification of this chemical agent, our knowledge that Russia has previously produced this agent and would still be capable of doing so, Russia's record of conducting state-sponsored assassinations, and our assessment that Russia views some defectors as legitimate targets for assassinations, the government has concluded that it is highly likely that Russia was responsible for the act against Sergei and Yulia Skripal.
Prime Minister May also told Parliament that either Russia was behind the poisoning or it somehow lost control of that nerve agent and someone else carried out the attack. Russia's foreign ministry has denied responsibility, accusing Britain of trying to whip up anti-Russian hysteria. Meanwhile, Sergei and Yulia Skripal remain hospitalized, both in critical condition. Finally today, Cuban jazz pianist Alfredo Rodriguez dropped by our studios recently. He's got a new album out produced by Quincy Jones. It's called The Little Dream. So the little dream as a title, it's an idea that's super relevant right now because you are referring to dreamers specifically these days. So that means recipients of DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. But how do you hear dreamers, the word, when you came up with the little dream as a title for this album?
Well, when I started composing the music, I was trying to translate words from a book that I read as a kid. The name is La Edad de Oro, The Golden Age. José Martí wrote this book for children. I felt that, you know, the dreamers has a lot in common with myself also, even though I am not, I didn't come here as a kid, but as an immigrant, the topic touched me also much. You know, my goal with the music is to make a better world. And I, in my humble opinion, this is the best that I can offer, you know, my music.
Well, that's pretty good. It's a pretty good offering. I want to hear more about your own story in a moment, but let's listen to something from the album. Dance Like a Child is a fantastic song, and I want to talk with you about it. So let's hear that. So this has got this kind of clave-ish 5-beat pattern through it. Tell me about the production and the composition. What were you thinking with this song, Dance Like a Child?
I was trying to imagine a child dancing from Cuba, you know, me, you know, myself or my friends or any kid from Cuba. You know, I guess I wanted to dedicate one of the songs in this kind of vibe. You know, as you see, it's not like one of the aggressive timba, but still have that tradition, that root from our country. And that was what I wanted to, yeah.
This song, particularly Dance Like a Child, the trio works so well here. That it sounds like you're having a conversation between the piano and the bass and the percussion. How else do you bring in other traditions?
The years that I grew up, I grew up in 1985, and we didn't have many confrontation and transculturation until I came here to the United States. That is why I like to incorporate into my music all of those cultures. And I've been able to collaborate with musicians from all over the world. In my previous album, Tocororo, I have musicians from Lebanon, France, India, Spain, the Cuba, Puerto Rico, many places, and Brazil, many places.
You're being a little modest. I mean, some of the names that you've collaborated with, Ibei, yes, who's been on the show, Esperanza Spalding, Pedrito Martinez. I mean, it's some heavy hitters. It's your collaboration, though, with Quincy Jones that's really interesting and a pretty integral part of your own story. Tell us about that.
Well, yeah, everything started in 2006. I was selected to play at the Montroyas Festival. Between 11, 12 pianists from the whole world.
Where does that festival take place?
Montroyas Festival is in Switzerland.
Montreux, yeah.
The Montroyas Festival. And the former president of the festival, Clown Knobs, he invited all of us to go to his house, to his chalet. And we were just hanging out, and he said, Quincy Jones is coming. Do you guys want to play for him?
Wow.
And obviously all of us, we said, yeah, of course we want to play for Quincy Jones. And we did. And very fortunately for me, after we finished the performance, Quincy came to myself and he said, hey, kid, I want to help you. For me, in 2006, it was impossible to come here because the relationships weren't at all good. So, you know, I had to make the difficult decision to leave my family behind while I was in Mexico. And I crossed the border from Mexico to the United States in January 2009. And since that moment, I've been working with Quincy.
So would you consider your move here kind of defection from Cuba?
Yeah, I defected. Yeah, I defected. Did. I asked for political asylum once I was at the border from Mexico to the United States.
And how did that go?
Well, you know, to be honest, the fact that just defecting for me wasn't that, you know, that, don't take me wrong, it's something really big in your life, but I was leaving my family behind, and that was the only thing that was in my head, you know.
Yeah.
I didn't know when I was going to be able to see them again physically, and you know that was a very difficult moment in my life. Adding to that I didn't know any English, I didn't know any of the United, you know, I didn't know anything about United States. So it was like kind of like following my dreams and my music. And
well, dream comes up again, and I want to ask you. I mean, you're not a dreamer, you're not a DACA recipient, but. Mm-hmm. How do you relate to this whole pool of people who we refer to as dreamers. Do you consider yourself a dreamer?
Well, definitely. Yeah, I consider myself a dreamer. You know, coming to a country like this with so many opportunities and leaving my family behind and just, you know, like doing everything for my passion for the music. I always say, you know, like little dreams can become big dreams, and big dreams definitely can become reality once you put your effort and once you're doing something 100% pure to your soul and your roots.
Alfredo Rodriguez, the new album is called The Little Dream. Great to meet you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much, Marco. It's a great honor for me to be here.
Guy and a great pianist. That is our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. There is a nor'easter headed our way again, but snow or more snow will be back here tomorrow. We'll see you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.